This is the lecture for Lesson 3 of the BSF study, People of the Promise, Exile and Return. I was on a flight recently, travelling from the US back to my home in Melbourne, Australia. We were just over 1 hour out of Melbourne when the plane took two sudden, rapid drops in altitude. The breakfast service was just concluding, and all the crockery and unsecured items in the cabin were suspended mid-air for what felt like a split second, and then all came crashing down. And that happened twice in quick succession. Now, there had been some similar incidents in different parts of the world at the time, and my mind immediately, probably unhelpfully, went to think of a documentary series which you may have watched before called Mayday, or in some countries it's called Air Crash Investigation, that recounts airplane crashes, hijackings, bombings, and other air disasters. I've watched almost every episode myself. Now, thankfully, I had my seatbelt on at the time, but in that split second, when there was just a bit of chaos, this particular question raced through my mind. And it's probably one of the most provoking and practical questions you can ask when facing a sudden turn of events. What should I do? What should I do? As in, how should I respond? You know, should I hold down the things that are around me? Or should I scribble down a few notes and start taking photos and videos as evidence of what's happening? You know, what should I do? How do you typically respond when faced with a sudden turn of events and you need to make a quick decision on what to do? Do you tend to panic and freeze, or do you tend to stay calm and gather your thoughts on how to respond? By default, what is your response in a crisis? In this week's lesson, we turn our minds to a young man named Daniel and to a book in the Old Testament which he wrote and that is named after him. The book spans most of his life from the time he was exiled as a teenager from the southern kingdom of Israel called Judah to the enemy nation of Babylon. It's estimated that he entered Babylon around 605 BC at the age of 16, and he lived there until he died in his mid-80s. The first two chapters of the book recount two crises which Daniel faced and how he responded when faced with the question, "What should I do?" And as we move through both chapters, his responses revealed how God strengthens his people for faithful living. And this was true not just in Daniel's day, but also in our day. As Malachi chapter 3 verse 6 tells us, God is constant. As God strengthened his people for faithful living in Daniel's day, he does the same in our day. And we have two divisions to take us through our lesson. The first division is chapter 1, which I've titled Faithful Commitment to God's Ways, because Daniel faced a situation that challenged his commitment to God. And the second division is chapter 2, which I've titled Faithful Courage in Serving God, because Daniel faced a situation where he needed immense courage to step out and do the work that God was giving him to do. So how does Daniel respond to the question, "What should I do?" Well, come with me to Daniel chapter 1. And right out of the gate, the promise of God was on the move. Verse 1 says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." For years, God had sent prophets to warn the people of Judah that if they would not faithfully commit to his ways, he would send the Babylonian army to take their capital city, that is Jerusalem, and take their temple in Jerusalem, and take their people into exile in Babylon. And verse 1 tells us this was happening right in front of their eyes. The choice had been theirs. If the people had faithfully committed to God's ways, then God promised his blessing and protection on the land he had given them. But the people disobeyed and ignored his ways and brought about their own downfall. God would prefer that his people be taken into captivity on enemy soil than for their waywardness to shame his holy name while they lived on the land he had given them. So Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, plundered the temple and relocated the spoils to his own temple in Babylon. This was his brazen way to mock the people of Judah by showcasing his God as greater than their God. But don't miss the detail in verse 2. Who was it really who brought about this situation? Was it King Nebuchadnezzar or someone else? Verse 2 says, "The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the king's hand." Here's the point. Among all the chaos of an enemy army invading the land and taking over their cities, their homes, their schools, their workplaces, and as Daniel watched life as he knew it unravel around him, he made an observation. Nebuchadnezzar seemed to be all-powerful and invincible, but that was only because the Lord God allowed it. God was orchestrating these events to accomplish his purposes. The king of Babylon may have thought his military conquests were his doing, but the eternal king of the universe was, in fact, directing it all. And it was with this truth about God's power and sovereignty over his situation etched in his mind that Daniel was among the first to be hauled off to Babylon as a young man, away from the comfort and stability of home, to face an unknown future in a foreign land. He was one of several in the royal family who had been handpicked to serve Nebuchadnezzar himself. Verse 4 tells us they were young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve. They were the cream of the crop, high capacity, physically able, and academically sharp. They were enrolled in a 3-year intensive course in Babylonian language and literature. The goal was to eradicate their Jewishness and replace it with the best of Babylonian thought, language, culture, religion, and ways of life. And that included changing their identities. Daniel, whose name means God is my judge, was given a new name, Belteshazzar, which means Bel protects, Bel being the chief of the Babylonian gods. His three friends also received new names. Hananiah, meaning Yahweh is gracious, was renamed Shadrach, meaning command of Aku, Aku being the moon god. Mishael, meaning who is like God, was renamed Meshach, meaning who is what Aku is. And Azariah, meaning Yahweh is my helper, was renamed Abednego, meaning servant of Nebu, Nebu being the Babylonian god of wisdom. Now it appears that for Daniel and his three friends, learning new habits and a new language, and even assuming new names, did not seem to bother them too much. They did not allow these things to define them. The real problem was when they were required to live in a way contrary to God's commands, and it had to do with the fine food and wines that the king gave them to enjoy. Now, we're not told exactly why the food and wine caused such offense, but God had given the Jews certain laws about food and drink in earlier books in the Old Testament, so that may have been a reason, and your lesson notes this week suggest some other reasons as well. In any case, it was enough of a problem for Daniel that he decided to object and to draw a firm line that could not be crossed. He did not try to justify it to himself that it was okay because he was no longer in Judah, or because he was now living among others who accepted these practices. He was faced with the question, "What should I do?" where he had to choose between God's commands and the king's cuisine. And he chose God's commands. So in verse 8, he resolved not to defile himself and began strategizing how to push back. The first official Daniel spoke with was Ashpenaz, and even though Ashpenaz refused to help him on this occasion, notice how Daniel still recorded in verse 9 that it was God who had caused Ashpenaz to show favor and sympathy to Daniel on other occasions. God was still on the move, directing all circumstances to accomplish his purposes. Even though Ashpenaz refused to help on this occasion, it did not derail God's plans. Daniel then spoke with another official who was the guard Ashpenaz had assigned to oversee Daniel and his friends, and Daniel proposed a test. Feed them only water and vegetables for 10 days, then examine if they were better off than the other young men who were not on this diet. The guard agreed, and 10 days later, they were not only as healthy and nourished as the other young men, but even more so. And having passed the test, they were officially given the diet they had requested that would not defile them. When faced with the question, "What should I do?" Daniel chose not to waver in his commitment to God's ways. I imagine it would have been tempting to just go with the flow and justify a few compromises, especially if they didn't seem to harm anyone else. But Daniel chose a different path. He understood that God strengthens his people to faithfully commit to his ways, and he chose not to compromise. And God honored him and his friends by strengthening them. And in their situation, we're told in verse 17, this included knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. So the king chose them to work for him because none were equal to them. God gave them such wisdom that they exceeded the king's expectations tenfold as compared to the magicians and enchanters in Babylon. And this leads to a key truth in this first division. God strengthens his people to stand firm in his ways. God strengthens his people to stand firm in his ways. In what area of life have you been choosing your ways rather than standing firm in God's ways? When Daniel faced this test, he didn't try to avoid it. He saw it as an opportunity to prove God, and God showed up. Daniel got to experience the wisdom and strength that God gives when his people stand firm in his ways. When we are faced with the question, "What should I do?" we can trust God to strengthen us to commit to his ways. And in chapter 2, God strengthened Daniel to step out and serve him with courage. The chapter begins with Nebuchadnezzar in a somewhat irritable state. It was the second year of his reign, and he had been losing sleep over a dream. At the time, dreams were believed to foretell future events, and not understanding the meaning of his dream gave rise to such anxiety about his future that he could not sleep. So he summoned his inner core of professional advisors, consisting of magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers who professed the ability to foretell the future, and he challenged them to tell him not only the dream, but also what it meant. In his mind, he would trust what they were saying about his future only if they were able to tell him about his past. And if they failed, he would slaughter them by cutting them into pieces and mowing down their houses. He was brutal. But it turned out there was a wrinkle. They could not do what he demanded. In fact, they needed him to tell them the dream first. And as despots were known to do in those days, he flew into a sudden rage. He accused them of buying time and conspiring to tell him misleading and wicked things. I'm not sure what was going through their mind at the time, but it's probably not a good sign when your boss accuses you of incompetence and then threatens to kill you. Well, at this point, the astrologers spoke up in defense. They told the king that no one on earth could do what he was asking, and the clincher is in verse 11. They said, "No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." In one fell swoop, they denounced not only themselves, but also the occult, astrology, sorcery, and all other kinds of human prophecy. Well, chapter 2 could end right there, because no one could interpret the dream. But it doesn't. Why? Because God was still on the move. God was paving the way for Daniel to step center stage to show this pagan king that there is one who determines the past, the present, and the future. But not before the king ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon, which included Daniel and his three friends. And so the king sent a search party to round them up, and Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, was in the search party. Now, Daniel and his friends were not present at the earlier meeting of the king and his inner circle of advisors. Perhaps they were too junior to be included in the inner circle. So when Arioch came to take him away to be executed, he had to ask Arioch what was happening. And Arioch explained, and once again, Daniel was faced with that question, "What should I do?" And this is what he did. He asked to see the king, who was willing to see him. Now, this may seem unusual to us, but remember the king had had positive impressions of Daniel, and Daniel hadn't been there with the wise men who failed to impress the king. So the king gave Daniel a hearing and granted his request for more time so he could interpret the dream. Now, this was no small feat. It took immense courage because this volatile king had just accused the wise men of wanting more time. Daniel knew this problem was greater and more serious than anything anyone could solve. So he got home, and he poured out his concerns to God in prayer, and he asked his three friends to pray. Together, they pleaded to the God of heaven to meet his need, and Daniel trusted God to hear their prayers and to respond for their good and for his own glory. And once again, God showed up. That night, God revealed the answer to the mystery that no human being could solve in the form of a vision. And what did Daniel do next? Well, he could have rushed over to the king to tell him all about the vision and take the credit for himself, but no. Just like in chapter 1, he acknowledged God for what God had done. How often do you and I acknowledge God as our first response when he answers our prayers? And Daniel acknowledged God through worship. In verses 19 to 23, he worshipped God for his power and sovereignty over time, seasons, and kings, and for the wisdom he gives to understand truth. And he thanked God for giving him wisdom and power to solve the mystery, because God had shone his light to reveal what was hidden in the darkness of the king's dream. Daniel then went to Arioch and asked to see the king. And did you pick up the nuance in what Arioch told the king? In verse 25, he said, "I have found a man who can tell the king what his dream means." Not quite, Arioch. You did not find Daniel. He came to find you. Arioch wanted the glory for himself. Daniel could well have chosen to also take the glory for himself. After all, he held the answer to the mystery that no one else could reveal. But Daniel chose to give the glory to God. And so he began by telling the king in verses 27 and 28, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain this dream, but there is a God in heaven who can." And Daniel began by telling the king the dream. Check out verse 31. Daniel says the king saw a dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The statue had five parts, a head made of gold, a chest and arms made of silver, a belly and thighs made of bronze, legs made of iron, and feet made of a composite of iron and clay. But then a rock enters the scene and pulverizes the statue to dust. A wind blows away all the dust, nothing is left, and in verse 35, the rock became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. At this point, I imagine the king just sat there stunned. His wise men had said no one on earth could tell him the dream. But Daniel just did. God was not only revealing himself to this pagan king through Daniel, but also validating Daniel as his servant and messenger to the king. Daniel then went on to interpret the dream. But before we get onto that, I want to make a quick comment about the nature of this dream. Notice the language earlier in verses 28 and 29. Daniel had said that God was showing the king what will happen in days to come, and what is going to happen. God could tell the king his future because his future would be directed by God in the way God foretold. This is because God is sovereign. We can trust what God says will happen in the future because he is directing all things across all time to accomplish everything he ordains. The king's dream was prophetic, and the fulfillment of Bible prophecy confirms the sovereignty of God over all things, including the kingdoms on this earth. And the interpretation of the dream was a masterpiece of divine revelation. First, Daniel told the king that the head of gold represented the Babylonian Empire led by the king himself. And Daniel did not mince his words. He told the king who really was in charge. In verses 37 and 38, he said it was the God of heaven who has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands, he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. This echoes all the other references to the sovereignty of God in these two chapters that we have seen. God in his sovereignty directs the rise and fall of nations. Daniel then moved on to the rest of the statue, and Bible scholars generally agree that the other sections each represented an empire or kingdom that would eventually come to an end. It's believed that the chest and arms of silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire led by Cyrus, which began in 539 BC. The belly and thighs of bronze likely represented the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great, which began in around 331 BC. And the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay likely represented the Roman Empire, which began in 63 BC. As for the iron, one Bible commentator notes that just as iron is stronger than bronze, silver, and gold, the Roman Empire was stronger than all the previous empires and managed to swallow up parts of their lands and people. As for the iron and clay, if iron and clay are heated to melting point in a crucible and poured into a mold to cool, the iron and clay remain separated, and the clay can be broken out, which weakens the overall structure. So Daniel said in verse 43 that just as iron is weakened by mixing it with clay, Rome would struggle to unite the diverse mix of people across its vast empire in order to form an united empire. God was revealing to the king the transience of the kingdoms in this world. As powerful as Babylon was at the time, it would be overtaken by other kingdoms coming after it. God determines the power and duration of all nations as he brings about the culmination of his master plan for this world, which involves the establishment of the final and ultimate kingdom, which will never end. And that is what God reveals next. Check out the rock. In verse 45, Daniel reiterated that the rock was not cut by human hands. The rock symbolized God and the beginning of the Messianic kingdom that would never end. The Messianic kingdom would be established by Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and Israel's Messiah. The Bible often uses this image of a rock as a symbol for Jesus, and this rock would smash the feet of the statue and supersede all the preceding kingdoms. Earlier in verse 35, we are told the rock became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. The kingdom of Christ would not be limited geographically. It would be over the whole earth. It would fulfill Bible prophecy in verses like 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 16, where God had promised Israel that Christ's kingdom would be established through a descendant of David. And Daniel ended as he began by giving glory to God. Fully confident in the truth of this message from God, he said in verse 45, "The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy." And the king was in awe. He fell prostrate before Daniel. What Daniel had just done, no other wise men could do. And so he said to Daniel in verse 47, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." And the edict to execute the wise men was withdrawn. The king personally promoted Daniel to a senior role in his administration, but Daniel had not forgotten his three friends who were with him through this harrowing experience. The king granted Daniel's request to also have them placed in senior roles where they all had influence across Babylon. When God had work for Daniel to do, Daniel faced that question, "What should I do?" He had a choice. Would he step out or would he shrink back? He chose to step out, and God strengthened him with the courage he needed to witness to the truth and power of God. And the result was probably way beyond his imagination. Not only were his and his friends' lives saved, but also those of the pagan wise men. And the pagan king got to encounter the truth of the sovereignty of God. One step of obedience by one person gave rise to a powerful testimony about God to these pagan men. And here's a key truth for the second division. God strengthens his people to serve him with courage. God strengthens his people to serve him with courage. Where is God giving you an opportunity to witness to his truth and power? Will you step out and trust him for the wisdom, for the strength, and for the courage to do the work that he is giving you to do? The promise and fulfillment of prophecy confirm God's sovereignty, and this means we can trust him. We can trust him with our past, with our present, and with our future. And when you next face the question, "What should I do?" trust him to strengthen you to stand firm in his ways, and trust him to strengthen you to serve him with courage.
This lecture was written and produced by Bible Study Fellowship. For more information on BSF resources and Bible study groups, please visit bsfinternational.org.